get that door fixed, someone said. Light flared around them. Duncan and Lucilla stared around at a large, richly furnished room, apparently cut into rock. Soft carpets covered the floor. Dark reds and golds of the figured pattern like repetitive battlements worked in pale green. A bundle of clothing lay in a jumble on a table near Brismali, who was in low-voiced conversation with one of their escort, a fair-haired man with high forehead and piercing green eyes. Lucilla listened carefully. The words were understandable, relating how guards had been posted, but the green-eyed man's accent was one she had never before heard. A tumble of gutturals and consonants clicked off with surprising abruptness. "Is this a no-chamber?" she asked. "No." The answer was supplied by a man behind her, speaking in that same accent. "The algae protect us." She did not turn toward the speaker, but looked up instead at the light yellow-green algae thick on the ceiling and walls. Only a few patches of dark rock were visible near the floors. Brismali broke off his conversation. "We are safe here. The algae has grown especially for this. Life scanners report only the presence of plant life and nothing else that the algae shields." Lucilla pivoted on one heel, sorting the room's details. That Harkonnen griffin worked into a crystal table. The exotic fabrics on chairs and couches. A weapons rack against one wall held two rows of long, field-style laser guns of a design she had never before seen. Each was bell-mouthed and with a curling gold guard over the trigger. Brismali had returned to his conversation with the green-eyed man. It was an argument over how they would be disguised. She listened with part of her mind while she studied the two members of their escort remaining in the room. The other three from the escort had filed out through a passage near the weapons cabinet, an opening covered by a thick hanging of shimmering, silvery threads. Duncan, she saw, was watching her responses with care, his hand on the small lace gun in his belt. "People of the scattering?" Lucilla wondered. "What are their loyalties?" Casually, she crossed to Duncan's side and, using the finger-touch language on his arm, relayed her suspicions. Both of them looked at Brismali. Treachery. Lucilla went back to her study of the room. Were they being watched by unseen eyes? 9 glow globes lighted the space, creating their own peculiar islands of intense illumination. It reached outward into a common concentration, near where Brismali still talked to the green-eyed man. Part of the light came directly from the drifting globes, all of them tuned into rich gold, and part of it was reflected more softly off the algae. The result was a lack of dark shadows, even under the furnishings. The shimmering silver threads of the inner doorway parted. An old woman entered the room. Lucilla stared at her. The woman had a seamed face as dark as old rosewood. Her features were sharply defined in a narrow frame of straggling gray hair that fell almost to her shoulders. She wore a long black robe worked with golden threads in a pattern of mythological dragons. The woman stopped behind a settee and placed her deeply veined hands on the back. Brismali and his companion broke off their conversation. Lucilla looked from the old woman down to her own robe. Except for the golden dragons, the garments were similar in design. The hoods draped back onto the shoulders. Only in the side cuts and the way it opened down the front was the design of the dragon robe different. When the woman did not speak, Lucilla looked at Brismali for explanation. Brismali stared back at her with a look of intense concentration. The old woman continued to study Lucilla silently. The intensity of attention filled Lucilla with disquiet. Duncan felt it too, she saw. He kept his hand on the small lace gun. The long silence, while eyes examined her, amplified her unease. There was something almost Bene Gesserit about the way the old woman just stood there looking. Duncan broke the silence, demanding of Brismali, "Who is she?" "I'm the one who'll save your skins," the old woman said. She had a thin voice that cracked weakly, but that same strange accent. Lucilla's other memories brought up a suggestive comparison for the old woman's garment, similar to that worn by ancient play femmes. Lucilla almost shook her head. Surely this woman was too old for such a role, and the shape of the mythic dragons worked into the fabric differed from those supplied by memory. Lucilla returned her attention to the old face, eyes humid with the illnesses of age. A dry crust had settled into the creases where each eyelid touched the channels beside her nose. Far too old for a play femme. The old woman spoke to Bersmali.
"I think she can wear it well enough."
She began divesting herself of her dragon robe. To Lucilla, she said,
"This is for you. Wear it with respect. We killed to get it for you."
"Who did you kill?" Lucilla demanded.
"A postulant of the honored Maters."
There was pride in the old woman's husky tone. "Why should I wear that robe?" Lucilla demanded.
"You will trade garments with me," the old woman said.
Not without explanation. Lucilla refused to accept the robe being extended to her. Bersmali took one step forward. "You can trust her."
"I am a friend of your friends," the old woman said.
She shook the robe in front of Lucilla.
"Here, take it."
Lucilla addressed Bersmali. "I must know your plan." "We both must know it," Duncan said. "On whose authority are we asked to trust these people?"
"Teg's," Bersmali said. "And mine."
He looked at the old woman.
"You can tell them, Serafa. We have time."
"You will wear this robe while you accompany Bersmali into Isai,"
Serafa said. Serafa, Lucilla thought. The name had almost the sound of a Bene Gesserit lineal variant. Serafa studied Duncan.
"Yes, he is small enough, yet he will be disguised and conveyed separately."
"No," Lucilla said. "I am commanded to guard him."
"You are being foolish," Serafa said. "They will be looking for a woman of your appearance, accompanied by someone of this young man's appearance. They will not be looking for a play femme of the honored Maters with her companion of the night, nor for Tlilazu master and his entourage."
Lucilla wet her lips with her tongue. Serafa spoke with the confident assurance of a house proctor. Serafa draped the dragon robe over the back of the settee. She stood revealed in a clinging black leotard that concealed nothing of a body still lithe and supple, even well-rounded. The body looked much younger than the face. As Lucilla looked at her, Serafa passed her palms across her forehead and cheeks, smoothing them backwards. Age lines grew shallow and a younger face was revealed. A face dancer. Lucilla stared hard at the woman. There were none of the other face dancer stigmata. Still.
"Get your robe off,"
Serafa ordered. Now her voice was younger and even more commanding. "You must do it," Bersmali pleaded. "Serafa will take your place as another decoy. It's the only way we'll get through."
"Get through to what?" Duncan asked.
"To a no-ship," Bersmali said. "And where will that take us?" Lucilla demanded.
"To safety," Bersmali said.
"We will be loaded with Cher, but I cannot say more. Even Cher wears off in time." "How will I be disguised as a Tlilazu?" Duncan asked.
"Trust us that it will be done," Bersmali said.
He kept his attention on Lucilla. Reverend Mother, you give me no choice, Lucilla said. She undid the quick fasteners and dropped her robe. She removed the small handgun from her bodice and tossed it onto the settee. Her own leotard was light gray, and she saw Serapha making note of this, and of the knives in their leg sheaths. We sometimes wear black undergarments, Lucilla said as she slipped into the dragon robe. The fabric looked heavy, but felt light. She pivoted in it, sensing the way it flared and fitted itself to her body, almost as though it had been made just for her. There was a rough spot at the neck. She reached up and ran a finger along it. That is where the dart struck her, Serapha said. We moved fast, but the acid scarred the fabric slightly. It is not visible to the eye. Is the appearance correct? Rosmali asked Serapha. Very good. But I will have to instruct her. She must make no mistakes, or they will have both of you like that. Serapha clapped her hands for emphasis. Where have I seen that gesture? Lucilla asked herself. Duncan touched the back of Lucilla's right arm, his fingers secretly quick-talking. That hand clap, a mannerism of Gaiety Prime. Other memories confirmed this for Lucilla. Was this woman part of an isolated community preserving archaic ways? The lad should go now, Serapha said. She gestured to the two remaining members of the escort. Take him to the place. I don't like this, Lucilla said. We have no choice, Rosmali barked. Lucilla could only agree. She was relying on Brismali's oath of loyalty to the sisterhood she knew. And Duncan was not a child, she reminded herself. His prana bindu reactions had been conditioned by the old Bashar and herself. There were abilities in the Gola that few people outside of the Bene Gesserit could match. She watched silently as Duncan and the two men left through the shimmering curtain. When they were gone, Serapha came around the settee and stood in front of Lucilla, hands on hips. Their gazes met at a level. Rosmali cleared his throat and fingered the rough pile of clothing on the table beside him. Serapha's face, especially the eyes, held a remarkably compelling quality. The eyes were light green with clear whites. No lenses or other artifice masked them. You have the right look about you, Serapha said. Remember that you are a special kind of play femme, and Brismali is your customer. No ordinary person would interfere with that. Lucilla heard a veiled hint in this. But there are those who might interfere. Embassies from great religions are on Gamu now, Serapha said. Some you have never encountered. They are from what you call the scattering. And what do you call it? The seeking. Serapha raised a placating hand. Do not fear. We have a common enemy. The honored maters? Serapha turned her head to the left and spat on the floor. Look at me, Bene Gesserit. I was trained only to kill them. That is my only function and purpose. Lucilla spoke carefully. From what we know, you must be very good. In some things, perhaps, I am better than you. Now, listen. You are a sexual adept. Do you understand? Why would priests interfere? You call them priests? Well, yes. They would not interfere for any reason you might imagine. Sex for pleasure. The enemy of religion, eh? Accept no substitutes for holy joy, Lucilla said. Tantras protect you, woman. There are different priests from the seeking. Ones who do not mind offering immediate ecstasy instead of a promised hereafter. Lucilla almost smiled. Did this self-styled killer of honored maters think she could advise a reverend mother on religions?
There are people here who go about disguised as priests, Sarratha said. Very dangerous. The most dangerous of all are those who follow tantras and claim that sex is the exclusive worship of their god.
How will I know them? Lucilla heard sincerity in Sarratha's voice and a sense of foreboding.
That is not a concern. You must never act as though you recognize such distinctions. Your first concern is to make sure of your pay. You, I think, should ask 50 solari.
You have not told me why they would interfere. Lucilla glanced back at Bursmali. He had laid out the rough clothing and was taking off his battle fatigues. She returned her attention to Sarratha.
Some follow an ancient convention that grants them the right to disrupt your arrangement with Bursmali. In actuality, some will be testing you.
Listen carefully, Bursmali said. This is important. Sarratha said,
Bursmali will be dressed as a field worker. Nothing else could disguise his weapons' calluses. You will address him as Scar, a common name here.
But how do I deal with the priest's interruption? Sarratha produced a small pouch from her bodice and passed it to Lucilla, who hefted it in one hand.
That contains 283 solari. If someone identifying himself as a divine, you remember that? Divine?
How could I forget it? Lucilla's voice was almost a sneer, but Sarratha paid no heed.
If such a one interferes, you will return 50 solari to Bursmali with your regrets. Also in that pouch is your playfem card in the name of Pira. Let me hear you say your name.
Pira.
No, accent much harder on the A.
Pira.
That is passable. Now listen to me with extreme care. You and Bursmali will be on the streets late. It will be expected that you have had previous customers. There must be evidence. Therefore, you will entertain Bursmali before leaving here. You understand?
Such delicacy, Lucilla said. Sarratha took it as a compliment and smiled. But it was a tightly controlled expression. Her reactions were so alien. One thing, Lucilla said, if I must entertain a divine, how will I find Bursmali afterward?
Scar.
Yes, how will I find Scar?
He will wait nearby wherever you go. Scar will find you when you emerge.
Very well. If a divine interrupts, I return 100 solare to Scar and
50!
I think not, Sarratha. Lucilla shook her head slowly from side to side. After being entertained by me, the divine will know that 50 solare is too small a sum. Sarratha pursed her lips and glanced past Lucilla at Bursmali.
You warned me about her kind, but I did not suppose that...
Using only a touch of voice, Lucilla said,
You suppose nothing, unless you hear it from me.
Sarratha scowled. She was obviously startled by voice, but her tone was just as arrogant when she resumed.
Do I presume that you need no explanation of sexual variations?
A safe assumption, Lucilla said.
And I do not need to tell you that your robe identifies you as a fifth stage Adep in the Order of Hormu.
It was Lucilla's turn to scowl. What if I show abilities beyond this fifth stage?
Ah,
Sarratha said.
You will continue to heed my words, then.
Lucilla nodded curtly.
Very good, Sarratha said. May I presume you can administer vaginal pulsing?
I can.
From any position?
I can control any muscle in my body. Serapha glanced past Lucilla at Bersmalli.
True.
Bersmalli spoke from close behind Lucilla. Or she would not claim it. Serapha looked thoughtful, her focus on Lucilla's chin.
This is a complication, I think.
Lest you get the wrong idea, Lucilla said. The abilities I was taught are not usually marketed. They have another purpose.
Oh, I am sure they do, Serapha said. But sexual agility is a...
Agility?
Lucilla allowed her tone to convey the full weight of a reverend mother's outrage. No matter that this might be what Serapha hoped to achieve, she had to be put in her place.
Agility, you say? I can control genital temperature. I know and can arouse the 51 excitation points. I... 51. But there are only... 51, Lucilla snapped. And the sequencing plus the combinations number 2008. Furthermore, in combination with the 205 sexual positions... 205? Serapha was clearly startled.
Surely you don't mean... More, actually, if you count minor variations. I am an imprinter, which means I have mastered the 300 steps of orgasmic amplification. Serapha cleared her throat and wet her lips with her tongue.
I must warn you, then, to restrain yourself. Keep your full abilities unexpressed, or...
Once more, she looked at Bersmalli.
Why didn't you warn me?
I did. Lucilla clearly heard amusement in his voice, but did not look back to confirm it. Serapha inhaled and expelled two hard breaths.
If any questions are asked, you will say you are about to undergo testing for advancement. That may quiet suspicion.
And if I'm asked about the test...
Oh, that is easy. You smile mysteriously and remain silent.
What if I'm asked about this order of Hormu?
Threaten to report the questioner to your superiors. The questions should stop.
And if they don't? Serapha shrugged.
Make up any story you like. Even a truthsayer would be amused by your evasions.
Lucilla held her face in repose while she thought about her situation. She heard Bersmalli, Scar, stirring directly behind her. She saw no serious difficulties in carrying out this deception. It might even provide an amusing interlude she could recount later at Chapter House. Serapha, she noted, was grinning at Scar. Lucilla turned and looked at her customer. Bersmalli stood there naked, his battle garb and helmet neatly stacked beside the small mound of rough clothing.
I can see that Scar does not object to your preparations for this venture, Serapha said.
She waved a hand at his stiffly up-cocked penis.
I will leave you then.
Lucilla heard Serapha depart through the shimmering curtain. Filling Lucilla's thoughts was an angry realization. This should be the Gola here now. It is your fate, forgetfulness. All of the old lessons of life. You lose and gain, and lose and gain again. Leto II, the voice of Daris Balat. In the name of our order and its unbroken sisterhood, this account has been judged reliable and worthy of entry into the Chronicles of Chapter House. Taraza stared at the words in her display projection with an expression of distaste. Morning light painted a fuzz of yellow reflections in the projection, making the words there appear dimly mysterious. With an angry motion, Taraza pushed herself back from the projection table, arose, and went to a south window. The day was young yet, and the shadows long in her courtyard. Shall I go in person? Reluctance filled her at this thought. These quarters felt so secure. But that was foolishness, and she knew it in every fiber. The Bene Gesserit had been here more than 1,400 years, and still Chapter House Planet must be considered only temporary. She rested her left hand on the smooth frame of the window. Each of her windows had been positioned to focus the attention on a splendid view. The room, its proportions, furnishing, colors, all reflected architects and builders who had worked single-mindedly to create a sense of support for the occupants. Terraza tried to immerse herself in that supportive feeling and failed. The arguments she had just experienced left a bitterness in this room. Even though the words had been voiced in the mildest tones, her counselors had been stubborn, and she agreed without reservation, for understandable reasons. Make ourselves into missionaries, and for the Tlilazu. She touched a control plate beside the window and opened it. A warm breeze perfumed by spring blossoms from the apple orchards wafted into the room. The sisterhood was proud of the fruit they grew here at the power center of all their strongholds. No finer orchards existed at any of the keeps and dependent chapters that wove the Bene Gesserit web through most of the planets humans had occupied under the old Imperium. By their fruits ye shall know them, she thought. Some of the old religions can still produce wisdom. From her high vantage, Terraza could see the entire southern sprawl of Chapter House buildings. The shadow of a nearby watchtower drew a long, uneven line across rooftops and courtyards. When she thought about it, she knew this was a surprisingly small establishment to contain so much power. Beyond the ring of orchards and gardens lay a careful checkerboard of private residences, each with its surrounding plantation. Retired sisters and selected loyal families occupied these privileged estates. Sawtooth mountains, their tops often brilliant with snow, drew the western limits. The space field lay 20 kilometers eastward. All around this core of Chapter House were open plains, where grazed a peculiar breed of cattle. A cattle so susceptible to alien odors, they would stampede in raucous bellowing at the slightest intrusion of people not marked by the local smell. The innermost homes with their pain-fenced plantings had been sited by an early bashar in such a way that no one could move through the twisting ground-level channels day or night without being observed. It all appeared so haphazard and casual, yet there was harsh order in it, and that, Terraza knew, personified the sisterhood. The clearing of a throat behind her reminded Terraza that one of those who had argued most vehemently in council remained waiting patiently in the open doorway. Waiting for my decision. The Reverend Mother Belanda wanted Odraid killed out of hand. No decision had been reached. You've really done it this time, Dar. I expected your wild independence. I even wanted it. Belanda, old, fat, and florid, cold-eyed and valued for her natural viciousness, wanted Odraid condemned as a traitor. The tyrant would have crushed her immediately, Belanda argued. Is that all we have learned from him? Terraza wondered. Belanda argued that Odraid was not only an Atreides, but also a Carino. There were emperors and vice-regents and powerful administrators to a very large number in her ancestry. With all of the power hunger this implies. Her ancestors survived Seleucia Secundus, Belanda kept repeating. Have we learned nothing from our breeding experiences? We learned how to create Odraids, Terraza thought. After surviving the spice agony, Odraid had been sent to Aldenab, an equivalent of Seleucia Secundus, there to be conditioned deliberately on a planet of constant testing, high cliffs and dry gorges, hot winds and frigid winds, little moisture and too much. It was judged a suitable proving ground for someone whose destiny might take her to Rakkis. tough survivors emerged from such conditioning. The tall, supple, and muscular Odraid was one of the toughest. How can I salvage the situation? Odraid's most recent message said that any peace, even the tyrant's millennia of suppression, radiated a false aura that could be fatal to those who trusted it too much. That was both the strength and flaw in Belanda's argument. Terraza lifted her gaze to Belanda waiting in the doorway. She is too fat. She flaunts that before us.
We can no more eliminate Odraid than we can eliminate the Gola, Terraza said.
Belanda's voice came low and level. Both are now too dangerous to us. Look how Odraid weakens you with her account of those words at C.H. Tabor. Has the tyrant's message weakened me, Bell? You know what I mean. The Benitlilax have no morals.
Quit changing the subject, Bell. Your thoughts are darting around like an insect among the blossoms.
What is it you really smell here?
The Tlilazu.
They made that Gola for their own purposes. And now Odraid wants us to...
You're repeating yourself, Bell.
The Tlilazu take shortcuts. Their view of genetics is not our view. It is not a human view. They make monsters.
Is that what they do?
Belanda came into the room, walked around the table, and stood close to Terraza, blocking the Mother Superior's view of the Nish and its statue of Chenoe. Alliance with the priests of Rakis, yes, but not with the Tlilazu. Belanda's robes rustled as she gestured with a clenched fist.
Bell, the High Priest is now a mimic face dancer. Ally with him, you mean?
Belanda shook her head angrily. Believers in Shai-Halud are legion. You find them everywhere. What will be their reaction to us if our part in the deception is ever exposed?
No, you don't, Bell. We have seen to it that only the Tlilazu are vulnerable there. In that, Odraid's right.
Wrong. If we ally with them, we are both vulnerable. We will be forced to serve the Tlilazu design. It will be worse than our long subservience to the tyrant.
Terraza saw the vicious glinting of Belanda's eyes. Her reaction was understandable. No Reverend Mother could contemplate the special bondage they had endured under the God Emperor without at least some chilling remembrances. Whipped along against their will, never sure of Bene Gesserit survival from one day to the next.
You think we assure our spice supply by such a stupid alliance? Belanda demanded.
It was the same old argument, Terraza saw. Without Melange and the agony of its transformation, there could be no Reverend Mothers.
The horrors from the scattering surely had Melange as one of their targets, the spice and the Bene Gesserit mastery of it.
Terraza returned to her table and sank into her chair dog, leaning back while it molded itself to her contours.
It was a problem, a peculiar Bene Gesserit problem. Although they searched and experimented constantly, the Sisterhood had never found a substitute for the spice. The Spacing Guild might want Melange to transform its navigators, but they could substitute Ixian machinery. Ix and its subsidiaries competed in the Guild's markets. They had alternatives. We have none.
Belanda crossed to the other side of Terraza's table, put both fists on the smooth surface, and leaned forward to look down at the Mother Superior.
And we still don't know what the Tlilazu did to our Gola.
Odraid will find out. Not reason enough to forgive her treachery.
Terraza spoke in a low voice.
We waited for this moment through generation after generation. And you would abort the project just like that.
She slapped a palm lightly against the table. The precious Rakian project is no longer our project, Belanda said. It may never have been.
All of her considerable mental powers in hard focus, Terraza re-examined the implications of this familiar argument.
It was a thing spoken frequently in the wrangling session they had concluded earlier. Was the goal of the scheme something set in motion by the tyrant? If so, what could they do about it now? What should they do about it? During the long dispute, the minority report had been in all of their minds. Shuang Yu might be dead, but her faction survived. And it looked now as though Belanda had joined them. Was the sisterhood blinding itself to a fatal possibility? Odrade's report of that hidden message on Rakis could be interpreted as an ominous warning. Odrade emphasized by this reporting how she had been alerted by her inner sense of alarm. No Reverend Mother could treat such an event lightly. Belanda straightened and folded her arms across her breast. We never completely escape the teachers of our childhood, nor any of the patterns that formed us, do we? That was an argument peculiar to Bene Gesserit disputes. It reminded them of their own particular susceptibility. We are the secret aristocrats, and it is our offspring who inherit the power. Yes, we are susceptible to that, and Miles Tang is a superb example. Alanda found a straight chair and sat down, bringing her eyes level with Taraz's. At the height of the scattering, she said, we lost some 20% of our failures. It is not failures who are coming back to us. But the tyrant surely knew this would happen. The scattering was his goal, Bell. That was his golden path, humankind's survival. But we know how he felt about the Tlilazu, and yet he did not exterminate them. He could have, and he did not. He wanted diversity. Belanda pounded a fist on the table. He certainly got that. We've been through all of these arguments over and over, Bell, and I still see no way to escape what Odrade has done. Subservience. Not at all. Were we ever totally subservient to one of the pre-tyrant emperors? Not even to Muad'Dib. We're still in the tyrant's trap, Belanda accused. Tell me, why have the Tlilazu continued to produce his favorite Gola? Millennia, and still that Gola keeps coming out of their tanks like a dancing doll. You think the Tlilazu still follow a secret order from the tyrant? If so, then you argue for Odrade. She has created admirable conditions for us to examine this. He ordered nothing of the kind. He merely made that particular Gola deliciously attractive to the Bene Tlilax, and not to us. Mother Superior, we must get ourselves out of the tyrant's trap now, and by the most direct method. The decision is mine, Bell. I still lean toward a cautious alliance. Then at the very least, let us kill the Gola. Shiana can have children. We could. This is not now, and never was purely a breeding project. But it could be. What if you're wrong about the power behind the Atreides' prescience? All of your proposals lead to alienation from Rakis and from the Tlilazu, Bell. The Sisterhood could weather 50 generations on your present stockpiles of melange. More with rationing. You think 50 generations is a long time, Bell? Don't you see that this very attitude is why you are not sitting in my chair? Belanda pushed herself back from the table, her chair scraping harshly against the floor. Taraza could see that she was not convinced. Belanda no longer could be trusted. She might be the one who would have to die. And where was the noble purpose in that? This gets us nowhere, Taraza said. Leave me. When she was alone, Taraza once more considered Odrade's message. Ominous. It was easy to see why Belanda and others reacted violently, but that showed a dangerous lack of control. It is not yet time to write the Sisterhood's final will and testament. In an odd way, Odrade and Belanda shared the same fear, but came to different decisions because of that fear. Odraid's interpretation of that message in the Stones of Rakus conveyed an old warning. This too shall pass away. Are we to end now, crushed by ravenous hordes from the scattering? But the secret of the Axolotl tanks was almost within the Sisterhood's grasp. If we gain that, nothing can stop us. Terraza swung her gaze around the details of her room. The Bene Gesserit power was still here. Chapter House remained concealed behind a moat of no-ships, its location unrecorded except in the minds of her own people. Invisibility. Temporary invisibility. Accidents occurred. Terraza squared her shoulders. Take precautions, but don't live in their shadows, constantly furtive. The litany against fear served a useful purpose when avoiding shadows. From anyone but Odraid, the warning message with its disturbing implications that the tyrant still guided his golden path would have been far less fearsome. That damnable Atreides talent. No more than a secret society. Terraza gritted her teeth in frustration. Memories are not enough unless they call you to noble purpose. And what if it was true that the Sisterhood no longer heard the music of life? Damn him! The tyrant could still touch them. What is he trying to tell us? His golden path could not be in peril. The scattering had seen to that. Humans had spread their kind outward on uncounted courses like the spines of a hedgehog. Had he seen a vision of the scattered ones returning? Could he possibly have anticipated this bramble patch at the foot of his golden path? He knew we would suspect his powers. He knew it. Terraza thought about the mounting reports of the lost ones who were returning to their roots. A remarkable diversity of people and artifacts, accompanied by a remarkable degree of secrecy and wide evidence of conspiracy. No ships of a peculiar design, weapons and artifacts of breathtaking sophistication, diverse peoples and diverse ways. Some astonishingly primitive, at least on the surface. And they wanted much more than melange. Terraza recognized the peculiar form of mysticism that drove the scattered ones back. We want your elder secrets. The message of the honored maters was clear enough, too. We will take what we want. Odraid has it all right in her hands, Terraza thought. She and Shiana. Soon, if Burzmali succeeded, she would have the Gola. She had the Tlilazu, Master of Masters. She could have Rakus itself. If only she were not an Atreides. Terraza glanced at the projected words still dancing above her tabletop. A comparison of this newest Duncan Idaho with all of the slain ones. Each new Gola had been slightly different from its predecessors. That was clear enough. The Tlilazu were perfecting something. But what? Was the clue hidden in these new face dancers? The Tlilazu obviously sought an undetectable face dancer. Mimics whose mimicry reached perfection. Shape copiers who copied not only the surface memories of their victims, but the deepest thoughts and identity as well. It was a form of immortality even more enticing than the one that Tlilazu masters used at present. That obviously was why they followed this course. Her own analysis agreed with the majority of her advisors. Such a mimic would become the copied person. Odraid's reports on the face dancer, Tuwek, were highly suggestive. Even the Tlilazu masters might not be able to shake such a face dancer out of its mimic shape and behavior. And its beliefs. Damn Odraid. She had painted her sisters into a corner. They had no choice except to follow Odraid's lead. And Odraid knew it. How did she do it? Was it that wild talent again? I cannot act blindly. I must know. Terraza went through the well-remembered regimen to restore a sense of calm. She dared not make momentous decisions in a frustrated mood. A long look at the statuette of Chenoweth helped. Lifting herself from the chair dog, Terrazza returned to her favorite window. It often soothed her to stare out at this landscape, observing how the distances changed with the daily movement of sunlight and shifts in the planet's well-managed weather. Hunger prodded her. I will eat with the acolytes and lay sisters today. It helped at times to gather the young around her and remember the persistence of the eating rituals, the daily timing, morning, noon, and evening, that formed a reliable cement. She enjoyed watching her people. They were like a tide speaking of deeper things, of unseen forces and greater powers that persisted, because the Bene Gesserit had found the ways of flowing with that persistence. These thoughts renewed Terrazza's balance. Nagging questions could be placed temporarily at a distance. She could look at them without passion. Odred and the tyrant were right. Without noble purpose, we are nothing. One could not escape, though, the fact that critical decisions were being made on Rakkis by a person who suffered from those recurring Atreides flaws. Odred had always displayed typical Atreides weakness. She had been positively benevolent to erring acolytes. Affections developed out of such behavior. Dangerous and mind-clouding affections. This weakened others who then were required to compensate for such laxity. More competent sisters were called upon to take erring acolytes in hand and correct the weaknesses. Of course, Odred's behavior had exposed these flaws in acolytes. One must admit this. Perhaps Odred reasoned thus. When she thought this way, something subtle and powerful shifted in Terrazza's perceptions. She was forced to put down a deep sense of loneliness. It rankled. Melancholy could be quite as mind-clouding as affection, or even love. Terrazza and her watchful memory sisters ascribed such emotional responses to awareness of mortality. She was forced to confront the fact that one day she would be no more than a set of memories in someone else's living flesh. Memories and accidental discoveries, she saw, had made her vulnerable. And just when she needed every available faculty. But I am not dead yet. Terrazza knew how to restore herself. And she knew the consequences. Always after these bouts of melancholy, she regained an even firmer grip on her life and its purposes. Odred's flawed behavior was a source of her mother superior's strength. Odred knew it. Terrazza smiled grimly at this awareness. The mother superior's authority over her sisters always became stronger when she returned from melancholy. Others had observed this, but only Odred knew about the rage. There. Terrazza realized that she had confronted the distressful seeds of her frustration. Odred had clearly recognized on several occasions what sat at the core of the Mother Superior's behavior. A giant howl of rage against the uses others had made of her life. The power of that suppressed rage was daunting, even though it could never be expressed in a way that vented it. That rage must never be allowed to heal. How it hurt. Odred's awareness made the pain even more intense. Such things did what they were supposed to do, of course. Bene Gesserit impositions developed certain mental muscles. They built up layers of callousness that could never be revealed to outsiders. Love was one of the most dangerous forces in the universe. They had to protect themselves against it. A reverend mother could never become intimately personal, not even in the services of the Bene Gesserit. Simulation. We play the necessary role that saves us. The Bene Gesserits will persist. How long would they be subservient this time? Another 3,500 years? Well, damn them all. It would still be only a temporary thing. Terrazza turned her back on the window and its restorative view. She did feel restored. New strength flowed into her. There was strength enough to overcome that gnawing reluctance which had kept her from making the essential decision. I will go to Ruckus. She no longer could evade the source of her own reluctance. I may have to do what Belunda wants. Survival of self, of species, and of environment. These are what drive humans. You can observe how the order of importance changes in a lifetime. What are the things of immediate concern at a given age? Weather? The state of the digestion? Does she or he really care? All of those various hungers that flesh can sense and hope to satisfy. What else could possibly matter? Leto II to Hui Nori, his voice, Dares Balat. Miles Teg awoke in darkness to find himself being carried on a litter sling supported by suspensors. By their faint energy glow, he could see the tiny suspensor bulbs in an up-dangling row around him. There was a gag in his mouth. His hands were securely tied behind his back. His eyes remained uncovered. So they don't care what I see. Who they were, he could not tell. The bobbing motions of the dark shapes around him suggested they were descending uneven terrain. A trail. The litter sling rode smoothly on its suspensors. He could sense the faint humming around the suspensors when his party stopped to negotiate the turn of a difficult passage. Now and then, through some intervening obstruction, he saw the flickering of a light ahead. They entered the lighted area presently and stopped. He saw a single glow globe about 3 meters off the ground, tethered on a pole and moving gently in a cold breeze. By its yellow glow, he discerned a shack in the center of a muddy clearing, many tracks in trampled snow. He saw bushes and a few sparse trees around the clearing. Someone passed a brighter hand light across his face. Nothing was said, but Teg saw a hand gesture toward the shack. He had seldom seen such a dilapidated structure. It looked ready to collapse at the slightest touch. He bet himself that the roof leaked. Once more, his party lurched into motion, swinging him toward the shack. He studied his escort in the dim light, faces muffled to the eyes in a cover that obscured mouths and chins. Hoods hid their hair. The clothing was bulky and concealed body details, except for the general articulation of arms and legs. The pole-tethered glow globe went dark. A door opened in the shack, sending a brilliant glare across the clearing. His escort hustled him inside and left him there. He heard the door close behind them. It was almost blindingly bright inside after the darkness. Teg blinked until his eyes adapted to the change. With an odd sense of displacement, he looked around him. He had expected the shack's interior to match its exterior. But here was a neat room almost bare of furnishings. Only 3 chairs, a small table, and... He drew in a sharp breath. An Ixion probe. Couldn't they smell the share on his breath? If they were that unaware, let them use the probe. It would be agony for him, but they would get nothing from his mind. Something clicked behind him and he heard motion. 3 people came into his field of vision and ranged themselves around the foot of the litter. They stared at him silently. Teg moved his attention across the 3. The one on his left wore a dark single suit with open lapels. Male. He had the squarish face Teg had seen on some Gamu natives, small, beady eyes that stared straight through Teg. It was the face of an inquisitor who would not be moved by your agony. The Harkonnens had imported a lot of those in their day, single-purpose types who could create pain without the slightest change of expression. The one directly at Teg's feet wore bulky clothing of black and gray, similar to that of the escort, but the hood was thrown back to reveal a bland face under closely cropped gray hair. The face gave nothing away, and the clothing revealed little. no telling if this one was male or female. Tegg recorded the face. Wide forehead, square chin, large green eyes above a knife-ridged nose, a tiny mouth pursed around a moo of distaste. The third member of this group held Tegg's attention longest. Tall, a tailored black single suit with a severe black jacket over it. Perfectly fitted. Expensive. No decorations or insignia. Male, definitely. The man affected boredom, and this gave Tegg a tag for him. Narrow, supercilious face, brown eyes, thin-lipped mouth. Bored, bored, bored. All of this in here was an unwarranted demand on his very important time. He had vital business elsewhere, and these other two, these underlings, must be made to realize that. That one, Tegg thought, is the official observer. The bored one had been sent by the masters of this place to watch and report what he saw. Where was his data case? Ah, yes, there it was, propped against a wall behind him. Those cases were like a badge for such functionaries. On his inspection tour, Tegg had seen these people walking the streets of Isai and other Gamu cities. Small, thin cases. The more important the functionary, the smaller the case. This one's case would barely contain a few data spools and a tiny comi. He would never be without an eye to link him with his superiors. Thin case. This was an important functionary. Tegg found himself wondering what the observer would say if Tegg asked, "What will you tell them about my composure?" The answer was already there on that bored face. He would not even answer. He was not here to answer. When this one leaves, Tegg thought, he will walk with long strides. His attention will be on distances where only he knows what powers await him. He will slap that case against his leg to remind himself of his importance, and to call the attention of these others to his badge of authority. The bulky figure at Tegg's feet spoke, a compelling voice, and definitely female in those vibrant tones. "See how he holds himself and watches us. Silence will not break him. I told you that before we entered. You are wasting our time, and we do not have all that much time for such nonsense." Tegg stared at her, something vaguely familiar in the voice. It had some of that compelling quality found in a reverend mother. Was that possible? The heavy-faced Gamu type nodded. "You are right, Materli. But I do not give the orders here." "Materli?" Tegg wondered. "Name or title?" Both of them looked at the functionary. That one turned and bent to his data case. He removed a small comi from it and stood with the screen concealed from his companions and Tegg. The eye came alight with a green glow which cast a sickly illumination over the observer's features. His self-important smile vanished. He moved his lips silently. Words formed only for someone on that eye to see. Tegg hid his ability to read lips. Anyone trained by the Bene Gesserit could read lips from almost any angle where they were visible. This man spoke a version of old Gallic. "It is the Bashar Tegg for sure," he said. "I have made identification." The green light danced on the functionary's face while he stared into the eye. Whoever communicated with him was in agitated movement, if that light meant anything. Again, the functionary's lips moved soundlessly. "None of us doubts that he has been conditioned against pain. And I can smell Cher on him. He will..." He fell silent as the green light once more danced on his face. "I do not make excuses." His lips shaped the old Gallic words with care. "You know we will do our best, but I recommend that we pursue with vigor all other means of intercepting the Gola." The green light winked off. The functionary clipped the eye to his waist, turned toward his companions, and nodded once. "The T-probe," the woman said. They swung the probe over Teg's head. She called it a T-probe, Teg thought. He looked up at the hood as they brought it over him. There was no Ixion stamp on the thing. Teg experienced an odd sense of deja vu. He had the feeling that his own captivity here had occurred many times before. No single incident deja vu. It was a deeply familiar recognition. The captive and the interrogators. These three. The probe. He felt emptied. How could he know this moment? He had never personally employed a probe, but he had studied their use thoroughly. The Bene Gesserit often used pain, but relied mostly on truth-sayers. Even more than that, the Sisterhood believed that some equipment could put them too much under Ixion influence. It was an admission of weakness, a sign that they could not do without such despicable devices. Teg had even suspected there was something in this attitude of a hangover from the Butlerian Jihad, rebellion against machines that could copy out the essence of a human's thoughts and memories. Deja vu. Mentat logic demanded of him, how do I know this moment? He knew that he had never before been a captive. It was such a ridiculous switch of roles. The great Bashar Teg a captive? He could almost smile. But that deep sense of familiarity persisted. His captors positioned the hood directly over his head and began releasing the Medusa contacts one at a time, fixing them to his scalp. The functionary watched his companions work, producing small signs of impatience on an otherwise emotionless face. Teg moved his attention across the three faces. Which one of these would act the part of friend? Ah, yes, the one called Materly. Fascinating. Was it a form of honored mater? But neither of the others deferred to her as one would expect from what Teg had heard of those returning lost ones. These were people from the scattering, though, except possibly for the square-faced male in the brown single suit. Teg studied the woman with care, the mat of gray hair, the quiet composure in those widely spaced green eyes, the slightly protruding chin with its sense of solidity and reliability. She had been chosen well for friend. Materly's face was a map of respectability, someone you could trust. Teg saw a withdrawn quality in her, though. She was one who would also observe carefully to catch the moment when she must become involved. Surely she was Bene Gesserit, trained at the very least. Or trained by the honored maters. They finished attaching the contacts to his head. The Gamu type swung the probe's console into position, where all three could watch the display. The probe's screen was concealed from Teg. The woman removed Teg's gag, confirming his judgment. She would be the source of comfort. He moved his tongue around in his mouth, restoring sensation. His face and chest still felt a bit numb from the stunner that had brought him down. How long ago had that been? But if he was to believe the silent words of the functionary, Duncan had escaped. The Gamu type looked to the observer.
You may begin, Yar. The functionary said.
Yar? Teg wondered. Curious name. Almost had a Tlilazu sound. But Yar was not a face dancer, or a Tlilazu master. Too big for one, and no stigmata of the other. As one trained by the Sisterhood, Teg felt confident of this. Yar touched a control on the probe's console. Teg heard himself grunt with pain. Nothing had prepared him for that much pain. They must have turned their devil's machine to maximum for the first thrust. No question about it. They knew he was a Mentat. A Mentat could remove himself from some demands of flesh, but this was excruciating. He could not escape it. Agony shivered through his entire body, threatening to blank out his consciousness. Could Cher shield him from this? The pain diminished gradually and went away, leaving only quivering memories. Again. He thought suddenly that the spice agony must be like this for a reverend mother. Surely there could be no greater pain. He fought to remain silent, but heard himself grunting, moaning. Every ability he had ever learned, Mentat and Bene Gesserit, was called into play, keeping him from forming words, from begging for surcease, from promising to tell them anything if they would only stop. Once more the agony receded, and then surged back. Enough. That was the woman. Teg groped for her name. Materly? Yar spoke in a sullen voice.
He's loaded with share, enough to last him a year at least.
He gestured at his counsel. Blank. Teg breathed in shallow gasps.
The agony.
It continued to increase despite Materly's demand. I said enough, Materly snapped. Such sincerity, Teg thought. He felt the pain recede, withdrawing as though every nerve were being removed from his body, pulled out like threads of the remembered agony. It is wrong what we're doing, Materly said. This man is...
He is like any other man, Yar said. Shall I attach the special contact to his penis?
Not while I'm here, Materly said. Teg felt himself almost taken in by her sincerity. The last of the agony threads left his flesh, and he lay there with a feeling that he had been suspended off the surface that supported him. The sense of déjà vu remained. He was here and not here. He had been here, and he had not.
They will not like it if we fail, Yar said.
Are you prepared to face them with another failure?
Materly shook her head sharply. She bent over to bring her face into Teg's line of vision through the Medusa tangle of probe contacts.
Bashar, I am sorry for what we do. Believe me, this is not of my making. Please, I find all of this disgusting. Tell us what we need to know, and let me make you comfortable.
Teg formed a smile for her. She was good.
He shifted his gaze to the watchful functionary.
Tell your masters for me. She is very good at this.
Blood darkened the functionary's face. He scowled. Give him the maximum, Yar. His voice was a clipped tenor without any of the deep training apparent in Materly's voice.
Please, Materly said.
She straightened but kept her attention on Teg's eyes. Teg's Bene Gesserit teachers had taught him that. Watch the eyes. Observe how they change focus. As the focus moves outward, the awareness moves inward. He focused deliberately on her nose. It was not an ugly face, rather distinctive. He wondered what the figure might be under those bulky clothes.
Yar!
That was the functionary. Yar adjusted something on his console and pressed a switch. The agony that surged through Teg now told him the previous level had indeed been lower. With the new pain came an odd clarity. Teg found himself almost capable of removing his awareness from this intrusion. All of that pain was happening to someone else. He had found a haven where little touched him. There was pain, agony even. He accepted reports about these sensations. That was partly the Sher's doing, of course. He knew that and was thankful. Materly's voice interrupted. I think we're losing him. Better ease off. Another voice responded, but the sound faded into stillness before Teg could identify the words. He realized abruptly that he had no anchor point for his awareness. Stillness. He thought he heard his heart beating rapidly in fear, but he was not sure. All was stillness, profound quiet with nothing behind it. Am I still alive? He found a heartbeat then, but no certainty that it was his own. Thump, 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 thump. It was a sensation of movement and no sound. He could not fix the source.
What is happening to me? Words blazoned in brilliant white against a black background played across his visual centers. I'm back to 1/3.
Leave it at that. See if we can read him through his physical reactions.
Can he still hear us?
Not consciously.
None of Teg's instructions had told him a probe could do its evil work in the presence of Cher. But they called this a T-probe.